In your Medium.com article, you said that we need to rethink our nightmares about surveillance. Why do we need to do that?
So a lot of our fears about government surveillance come from the past and come from people who were thinking of different kinds of governments. They were thinking of the Soviet Union. They were thinking maybe a little bit about things like what happened in East Germany, which were more totalitarian and which were more based on ruling on fear and controlling people. That is not the correct way, I think, to think about the dangers of surveillance moving forward, because at least in Western Europe or in Eastern Europe too, increasingly, and in North America, most of the world, we're a lot more freer than before. Totalitarianism of the old kind, you know, the Nazis or the Soviet Union, is not on the agenda. But what is on the agenda is capitalism and democracy, but one in which the people who are trying to sell us products and the people who are trying to sell us politicians have a lot of data on us. So it's an information asymmetry environment where they can look at all the data they have on us and figure out what we like, what we don't like, what kind of a person we are, what else is going on, and convince us by targeting us with very effective nudges, not necessarily advertisements, because we see an advertisement, we think, oh, that's an advertisement, and we're on guard. More like figuring out, oh, this person is afraid of this. Let's scare them just a little bit, and let's suggest this a little bit. Or they're not feeling very good today. Here, let's sell makeup to them. Or this is an issue they care about. Let's just advertise to them, you know, in a subtle way so that they think we really care about this issue as a politician. So I think, you know, instead of 1984, you know, this really fearful, scary world, I'm more afraid of how governments and politicians and corporations can use the data they have on us to try to make us do things seemingly of our own will, but in an environment that's designed to, you know, push us gently, gently, gently in a particular direction, which is a lot more effective than scaring us, because if we're scared, we can push back.
After the Snowden leaks, we live in a world that seems surreal in a way. Is this the reason why we use dystopian science fiction novels to explain what is happening, because our reality has become a dystopian sci-fi novel?
Well, one thing is the Snowden revelations have shown how much surveillance there is on us by governments and corporations. I mean, I call it the surveillance industrial complex, because if all these corporations weren't collecting this much data on us, there wouldn't be anything for governments. But I'm going to disagree slightly on the dystopian science fiction novel, because the surveillance is real. But most ordinary citizens don't live in a climate of fear. You know, we're not going to be detained at 3 a.m. at night, and we're not really living in a very dystopian world yet. We go about our business, we buy things, you know, we get to vote, we have elections. So the dystopian science fiction novels that we think of when we hear all these surveillance, they don't really sound real to me. And I think this is one of the reasons, like when I talk to my students about these issues, they look around and they think, oh, 1984, that's the first metaphor they think of. And then they look around. This is not like the world described in 1984. This is not a nightmare world. We're still open. We're still free. So then they disregard the danger. And that's what I was objecting to. I think there is a real danger. I think the information asymmetry and this level of information by governments and corporations who are not totalitarian is still a power imbalance, and I think there are a lot of downsides to that. But I don't think what is likely to happen is, you know, we will all be sort of afraid to say anything politically. What will likely happen that I'm afraid of is that our politics and our, you know, consumer choices will be shaped by this maze that's set up for us, in which we go do things we like, but we're actually in a maze.
You just mentioned Orwell's and the 1984 novel. If we look at another classic science fiction dystopian novel, Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, the humans or the people there, they are not being born, they are bottled, they are made, and their lives are being programmed, and there's a drug called Soma that makes them happy regardless of their social class. Everyone uses it, and if not, they're forced to use it. Did I get this right, that you think that big data and all this advertising, the things that you just described, big data is the Soma of our time?
That's exactly right. I do think that big data has the potential to act like a kind of Soma, in which they can use, you know, we have every day thousands of little imprints about us are just around the internet. And increasingly what we know is using, you know, scientific articles and research, we can see that big data holders can figure out, for example, things like what's your personality type according to, you know, sort of the scientific basis of psychology. There's this thing called the Big Five personality measures, whether you're extroverted, introverted, neuroticism scale. These are very well-validated scales that are used in psychology to measure people's personality types. Now, according to an article in a very prestigious high-level scientific journal, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, just using Facebook likes, people can figure out people where they are on these psychology scales without asking them a single question. So I already know what you buy, I know what you read, I know who your friends are, and I know what kind of a person you are. It's not that hard to push people gently without them even knowing in directions that we want them to go. You know, there was an article that said, oh, we should advertise makeup to women when they feel bad, when they feel bad on Mondays. Well, you know, why stop there? We were using sort of people's online, say, Twitter or Facebook status updates. We can figure out if they're depressed. You know, you can figure out when somebody's feeling bad, and then you don't even have to advertise very strongly to them. You can catch the people when they're feeling bad and say, oh, look, some makeup, some stuff, you know, consumer things to make you feel better. And why stop there? You can start trying to make people feel bad if the product you're selling is better sold if people are afraid. Or on the other hand, maybe there's some people, let's say you're a politician and fear-mongering backfires among some people. If you can identify them, you can fear-monger, you can have scary messages to the people for whom fear will get them to vote for you, while being completely different to people for whom fear-mongering will make them think, oh, you're trying to manipulate them. So you can manipulate everybody quietly, nicely, gently, and at an individual level so nobody sees the other person's. So I think those are, you know, this is a kind of Soma.
There are actually dystopian ideas which are modern, like Cory Doctorow's Little Brother, for example.
Yes.
To what extent can those novels help us understand what's happening right now?
Right. I think, you know, fiction is very useful. And yes, as you mentioned, Cory Doctorow's great book, those are very useful for us to sort of imagine the range of possibilities. And modern dystopias, I think, are good ways to start thinking about it. And I think we need to start looking at the scientific literature on this, you know, as science fiction always feeds from scientific literature. And increasingly, we're seeing how powerful this data is. And we have to keep in mind this data. Like, if you wanted to look at large-scale data on people's social behavior online, there aren't that many sources. This data is held by Facebook. This data is held by Google. This data is held by Twitter. So the owners of this data are very few. And the research on this data can only be done to the degree they permit us. So we don't even know the full power of what can be figured out with this data, because it's not data that anybody, any researcher can have access to. But even with, you know, the limited view we have into it shows how powerful it can be. And the fact that it's proprietary and that, you know, governments have access to this data through surveillance and corporations have this access to this data because they own it shows we really have to expand our imagination and move away only from an environment where we think the government's going to use this to identify someone and go arrest them, and think, you know, of how this will be put in a maze where we think we're making our own choices, but they'll be very guided at each level in an environment of information asymmetry when they know a lot about us, but we don't know what kind of information they're using to structure our environment.
After all these dystopian perspectives, do you see any hope, a way out of this mess?
Well, actually, I think these technologies are also wonderful. I think they allow us to talk to each other. They allow us to connect. They allow us to think. So I personally don't think they're just dystopia. I think it's utopia and dystopia mixed into one. It's not good or bad. It's both. It's using the same technologies, I think we can get together, discuss, and exactly because we don't live in totalitarian states, we're not prisoners. We are citizens. And we can say, wait, you know, what do we want our government to have data on us? How do we want it? And we can say, well, what about these corporations? We can rethink data ownership. We can rethink data use. And when we faced with previous technologies before, we changed our laws to try to deal with their effects. I think we should do that. We can change our laws. We can also talk to these companies. I mean, these companies aren't full of people who are thinking, oh, how do I do bad things? They're thinking, how do we do the best? They're corporations. They're thinking, how do we make money? But they're also thinking about how to do the right thing. I think there's a wrong image often of these companies as not thinking through these things and their social impacts. They are. So we should engage them and say, look, as your users, these are our concerns. A problem has been the technology is moving so fast. It's moving very fast. It's moving faster than the ability of either governments or people or the corporations themselves to really get a handle on it. So there needs to be a lot more attention on these new architectures, and there needs to be very engaged dialogue in which people speak and discuss and go to these corporations, go to their governments, go to each other and say, how do we want to shape the future of these technologies so that we don't end up in a world in which the information asymmetry puts us in mazes, but where we can use these technologies to empower ourselves?
Is offline maybe a solution? In Brave New World, the few people who are living a natural life are called savages. Do you see a connection there to people who are refusing to use social media or the internet in general?
It's a good question. I don't think so. I mean, being an engaged citizen in the 21st century requires using these technologies. I mean, this is how we connect to people. This is how people organize their protests. This is how people organize to challenge corporations and governments. I don't think, you know, hiding and not engaging is a solution. Many people will, for example. I mean, it's like, let's think of it like the environment. It's good for people to recycle. But if, you know, there's a factory down the road that is spewing incredible amount of pollution, just the fact that you recycle is not going to solve the problem. These are society level issues. These are not going to be solved by individually opting out, partly because the opting out will disengage you from the world when we actually need is more engagement. It's kind of like saying, you know, if you don't like bad books, you shouldn't read or write. That's just not the way to go forward, because these are also the technologies that we use to keep in touch with friends, to look up things, to engage politically, to create civic spaces. And just staying out of it, one, it wouldn't stop all this. Two, it would disempower us. And three, I don't even think most people would. So I don't really see that as a solution. But I think people can think about their data practices. They can try to figure out their online footprint. They can choose their companies. They can find out privacy-protecting tools. They can go ask for privacy-protecting tools. They can go support companies that are better for their privacy. They can use, you know, encryption when they want to sort of keep their data to themselves. There are a lot of things consumers can do. Unfortunately, it is like a burden. You have to think about these things. You have to wonder about, you know, what do I need to do? And most people are like, oh, I just want to, you know, go do my thing and not worry about it. But I don't think it's a good solution. I would rather people thought, how do we engage this world thoughtfully? How do we engage this world so that we can change it rather than trying to stay out of it?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dana.